but we begin with keeping your streets safe. We mentioned to you yesterday that the United States Attorney is going to help, maybe put some boots on the ground, helping to, you know, get the drug dealers out, get the violent folks out of our community, get the real serious criminals in the jailhouse where they belong, and make the streets and neighborhoods safer. The U.S. Attorney Joe Hogsett is here, and I want to begin with an email that I got this morning from somebody, and it said, "Amos, in the last week, IPS has lost one of our students, a 19-year-old John Marshall student who was shot and killed. A 24-year-old mother of one of our kindergarten students was shot and killed last Friday in Fountain Square. And yesterday, the mother of two IPS children was stabbed to death. How can we expect our children to learn to thrive when they are surrounded by all of this violence? It makes me so sad. We, as a caring community, are better than this. For our children, we must do better than this." U.S. Attorney Joe Hogsett is here. Mr. Attorney, welcome.
I'm pleased to be here, Amos.
How do you respond to a letter like that? I mean, he's talking about three of the murders that have occurred in this city in the last 4 or 5 days. One, the 19-year-old out on the far east side of the city, 24-year-old mom last Friday in Fountain Square, and then the tragedy yesterday. Somebody sounds like a domestic. We don't have all the details. Just tragedies all over. What has motivated the feds to get more engaged?
Well, it has been a difficult week for the city of Indianapolis, Amos. And, you know, I would respond to the email by emphasizing that when I became the United States Attorney 2.5 years ago, I made a vow that I would do everything I could to protect the families and the children of this community, regardless of where they lived, their race, their economic status, every bit as passionately as I would protect my own children. And that's what this week's announcement by federal law enforcement is really all about. That is protecting our neighborhoods and protecting our citizens, particularly in those high crime areas, so that they can live and work and educate their kids and have the kind of life that they deserve.
In this morning's Indianapolis Star, Erica Smith, the columnist, raises a number of issues. One of the questions is, does this mean that a crime that occurs in a so-called high-crime neighborhood that may be a predominantly African-American neighborhood is more important to the feds than if somebody gets murdered out in Piketown, out in far the Pike Township, or out in Nora?
Fair question, and I should start by saying I really found Erica's article this morning to be very thoughtful and very provocative. I mean, she's asking the right questions. The answer, though, Amos, is we are not focusing law enforcement on neighborhoods and zip codes per se, although those terms get thrown around a lot. Mm-hmm. The effort that federal law enforcement is assisting IMPD in making targets not neighborhoods or zip codes. Mm-hmm. It targets the criminals mm-hmm. who happen to live in those neighborhoods mm-hmm. and zip codes. Mm-hmm. Now, frankly, there happen to be certain neighborhoods in the city who that experience higher rates of crime than others. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the motivation of law enforcement generally, and particularly the federal involvement, is not necessarily motivated by anything other than going where the crime rates are the highest and helping those in those neighborhoods keep their neighborhoods as safe as they can.
Does that mean – that does not mean FBI agents patrolling neighborhoods. What does that mean?
Well, it means from our perspective, working alongside our local law enforcement partners, the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. I should say at the very outset, Amos, that Public Safety Director Troy Riggs needs to be commended. Mm-hmm. Many months ago, he started a lengthy process to put together an anti-crime strategy for the city. Mm-hmm. It's a very involved, long-term effort that I think will prove to be very, very successful over the long run. But in the short run, mm-hmm. I think the federal participation is most effective in assisting Public Safety Director Riggs, in assisting Police Chief Height, and IMPD generally in addressing those acts of violence, particularly gun-related violence, in the short run, so that there can be an immediate response as the city itself and as the public safety director works on what I believe will be a successful long-term anti-crime strategy.
As you all look at this, and let me walk through some of the things that I think you guys are talking about. One has to do with something called a federal zero-tolerance zone. What is that? Because somebody hearing that would think, okay, that's supposed to deal with Al Qaeda. That's supposed to deal with, you know, like these dummies in Boston. What's a zero tolerance zone? Some people listening may think that was more that should be more for the war against terror as opposed to the war against the hood.
Well, in essence, what it means is that any form of gun related violence is unacceptable. No one should have to live in a neighborhood where they feel like their kids can't ride their bikes safely down the streets. And as a result, and particularly because the federal law enforcement family, the FBI, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the DEA, all of my federal partners are uniquely well-positioned and qualified to assist IMPD. What zero tolerance means is that the United States Attorney's Office and federal law enforcement working together with IMPD will simply address on a case-by-case basis every instance where an act of violence, particularly one that involves a gun, and all too often that's what we've seen over the last week, that we will on a case-by-case basis be willing to consider the possibility of federal prosecution of every single one of those incidents.
The other thing in some information that the folks from your office provided me was something as it relates to handguns and juveniles, regardless of how anybody feels about the Second Amendment, and you are a constitutional officer of the judiciary of this country, so you're sworn to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, which includes the Second Amendment, but juveniles are not supposed to have weapons, period, end of statement, move on. You're talking about every handgun illegally possessed by a juvenile you're going to trace to try to find out whose gun is it?
I think that's a critical effort that needs to be done, and maybe more concentrated effort now more than ever to find out how our kids, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids, are obtaining the guns. I have my suspicions, but I don't really have any kind of statistics that tell me 15-year-olds can obtain guns here or there or from this person or at this place. And as a result, I think it's very important to work hand-in-hand with the Marion County Prosecutor's Office. I think it's important to work hand-in-hand with the juvenile court to try to find out, number one, how the kids are obtaining the weapons in the first place.
Has anybody ever done and maybe you can't answer that because that's a question dealing with tactics, but has anybody ever done a sting with juveniles in using them as the bait to find out where they're getting the weapons from?
Well, I do know that Amos back, I think when Jeff Modisette was prosecutor some 20 years ago, in conjunction with Judge Payne, who I believe was the juvenile court at the time, I think there was an effort that involved the Marion County Prosecutor's Office in working with juveniles that had been charged with gun-related offenses to add to the list of questions, where did you get the gun? How did you get the gun? Who gave you the gun? That kind of effort, I think, over time fell by the wayside, and it's certainly one that I think ought to be implemented again. But I want to make clear, as the United States Attorney, it's the policy of the Department of Justice that we focus all of our prosecutions on adults. Juveniles are exclusively the province of local law enforcement. So my suggestions are just merely that, suggestions.
239-1310, 239-1310, Zap the News with Amos. We are talking with the United States Attorney, Joe Hogsett, about the federal presence in certain neighborhoods where there is a propensity of violent crime. And I know IMPD is looking at this over 5 to 7 years, including what the trends are this year. You all are, and I think where some of the confusion and maybe some of the concern is, IMPD is talking zip codes, which in this community are some very large geographic areas that include relatively peaceful neighborhoods mixed with pockets of very violent neighborhoods, even in some of the so-called hot zip codes. There's some very peaceful neighborhoods. Is there a danger that we overemphasize a wide zip code and not deal with actual specific neighborhoods or specific intersections where maybe there's a greater problem than others?
Yeah, sure, there's a danger in overemphasizing the problem. But the fact remains, Amos, that there are neighborhoods in our city where crime statistics bear out that there is a high degree of crime. In fact, if you give me about 30 seconds, I'd like to address that question by reading to your listeners a letter that I received this morning that goes directly to your point. A woman wrote me in the United States Attorney's Office. I won't mention her name. She said, just today I learned of the efforts to have federal law enforcement join with Indianapolis authorities to fight crime in so-called hotspot areas. She goes on to say, I reside in one of them, 46218. I've owned my home for 20-plus years. I've gotten to know many of my neighbors. We participate in Crime Watch. We all take pride in our homes, and we maintain them well. All of our efforts have done little to combat the growing encroachment of serious crime. Mostly, we have dealt with break-ins. As time has passed, now we're seeing an escalation to more severe crimes, drug activity, gun violence, shootings. We want to have our neighborhood be the friendly, diverse, safe, middle, and working class neighborhood it always has been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, here is a woman who appreciates the fact that the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, along with federal law enforcement and all of our partners, are helping focus in those areas where people are living with, unfortunately, increased amounts of crime, to protect those people and their families and to allow them to enjoy the same kind of life that everyone else in this community should be able to enjoy.
It's your opportunity to talk to the U.S. attorney, 239-1310, 239-1310. It's afternoon. His name is now. I got to remind you, he is a federal judicial officer, so he cannot comment. And he ain't going to comment on any cases that are active, even if you and I don't know they're active. He knows that whether they're active or not, or a case that is currently before a federal court, or a case that is on federal appeal. All right, so we got the groundwork. Because I don't want Clarence Thomas to come after me. Or more importantly, I don't want Sonia Sotomayor. Because if she finds out that I broke the rules, she's coming after me. Not Clarence, ignore me. Sonia, Sister Sonia, and Sister Elena, both of them are going to come get me. 239-13, tell me, start today with Bill. Hi there.
Oh, good afternoon, Amos.
Good afternoon.
And to the attorney.
Hey, Bill.
Okay. Hey, I am going to make a remark.
Okay,
all these crimes that are committed in these neighborhoods, if people know who the perpetrators are and won't come forward, that's what makes me mad. How I found this out, my daughter came and lived with me for 2 years. That is the way of life for them. That's what they do. They sit around, they talk about who did this, and they will not report this to the proper authorities. My thing is, I fought 99% of that on the people who live in the neighborhood. I'll give you one example. In my neighborhood, it was two drug houses. I went one morning, 4 a.m. in the morning, and told them I will call the authorities on them. I put a note under their doors. 2 weeks later, they was gone. That's the thing we have to do. You know what I'm saying? I am 66 years old. I'm from the old school.
Mm-hmm.
I do not own a gun. I grew up with guns. My uncle used to have, he was in World War II. He had all kind of guns. I owned a gun at 15 years old. That's what I'm saying. You have to put all this politics and somebody else raising your child. you guys, the FBI and the police, they can do so much. It's up to the neighborhoods to do this. You have to testify on these people and tell them who did this. That is the I think that is the way it should go. And thank you and bless both of you guys.
All right, I appreciate it. Bill brings up a point, United States Attorney. Would the Justice Department consider the types of things that you do to protect the integrity of witnesses, the safety of witnesses, the kinds of things that then in other kinds of cases, not only here in this district, but across the country, to protect the safety of people willing to testify?
Absolutely, Amos. And I think Bill probably hit the nail as squarely on the head as anyone can. We simply are not, as law enforcement officials or prosecutors, we cannot prosecute our way out of this problem. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's why Public Safety Director Riggs has involved community organizations, ministerial associations, neighborhood groups in his efficiency review teams. Mm-hmm. Because it really does take, as Bill underscores, for us to meaningfully address the issues presented by high crime, mm-hmm. it's going to take a community commitment, all of us working together to make our streets safe.
Is it going to require the same commitment that people look to spot potential terrorists, or hey, there's a bag over there, somebody needs to check that to make sure that's not the boogeyman with a bomb that's gonna, you know, injure people, or it could be a weapon of mass destruction. I think the Homeland Security calls, if you see something, say something. That seems to work in the fight against terror. Does that same kind of strategy and awareness need to be there's a fight against terror in our neighborhoods?
Absolutely. See something, say something is a very good example of where, and frankly, with the Boston Marathon bombings only a few weeks ago, we are reminded about how vigilant everyone in our country must always remain. But the fact is that since 9/11, there have been very, very few organized terrorist attacks in the homeland or on our own soil here. And that is due to the good work of law enforcement, but it's also due to the good work of people from communities all across the country bringing information to law enforcement when applicable to keep the country and their states and neighborhoods safe.
Let me go to Larry at 239-1310. Hi there.
Be careful what you ask for. When they consolidated the sheriff and IMPD, I said that it was a move to have the feds take over local policing authorities. Now that Joe Hogsett, Attorney Hogsett, have taken jurisdiction over our local enforcement in select areas, they're going to have a crush because they're going to go out in the neighborhoods. They're going to knock off all the old dope boys, get them in prison, and they're going to serve 85% of their times, and they're going to understand that our neighborhood is now dependent on this vice as a way of life to put money in some of our pockets. So if you ask for it, I heard people calling in every time, we want the feds to come in, the feds to come in. The feds are going to be ruthless. They have all the latest high-tech gadgets from eavesdropping to GPS systems that they can spy on your mail or do anything they want, come in your house and take a peek if they want to. There's nothing you're going to be able to do about it. And it's going to end up, because of the first initial crush of murders, they're going to have them walking the streets with the M16s on their side, just like after the Boston Marathon, just like any other tragedy that occurs. So people in this city have downed the local law enforcement. Now they're going to get a taste of what the feds is going to do to them, and they bought it on themselves. So, hey, I'd just be surprised to see when the first crush of murder comes in.
All right, so now, U.S. Attorney, have you taken over, as Larry said, law enforcement of the M16s coming out?
Well, I appreciate Larry's perspective, but I have to respectfully disagree. I mean, as the United States Attorney, I have, I think, an important supplementary or complementary role to play. But at the end of the day, the jurisdiction of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, the public safety director. They run the show along with the Marion County prosecutor. We are well served in this community, in my opinion, by people like Terry Curry, by people like Troy Riggs, by Police Chief Rick Height. We, as federal law enforcement, take our direction from them and simply try to assist, particularly in those areas where they believe our assistance could benefit the community as a whole. That's pure and simple what federal law enforcement's commitment is.
239-1310, 239-1310. After the news, name is back to the phones. And James, hi there.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine.
Good. My question is, I've called and asked the same question before, and I'll ask it to the Attorney General. What about the legitimate businessman that has an old felony, over 20 years old? How does he protect his business?
That's a great question. This has come up before. I think what James is talking about, he's a legitimate business person. He made a mistake back in his life. He's considered a felon. The gun laws are very clear. Felons cannot carry weapons. How then does he protect himself? That's a great question.
It is a great question.
Yeah, that's what the NRA ought to be asking.
Well, and you know what, Amos, I've been asked that before. I always have to be. I have to offer the disclaimer that as the United States Attorney, I don't have any authority to make or change the laws. Mm-hmm. But I think it is a fair question that after a long period of time of peaceful existence, why somebody who made a mistake 20 or 30 years ago but has led a law-abiding life since then might not be given some consideration in that regard. But again, members of Congress, members of the General Assembly, those are the folks that make the laws. I simply take the laws as they give them to me and apply them as fairly across the board and as even-handedly as I can.
And James, as the United States Attorney was mentioning that, I think since the last time you called, there is the new state law that has sharply reduced the waiting period for expungements on a number of crimes. That law will take effect July 1st. And it specifically is saying expungement as opposed to that other law that was just kind of taking care of shielding criminal information from background checkers. And this is something we're going to focus on probably in late June or in July as we start understanding what the law means. And I don't want to get into what your offense was.
Sure.
But that may open up some rules because that passed both houses of the legislature by a bipartisan basis. When the governor signed the bill, he made a public note that he was signing the bill. So that was something that he approved of. And I think it was all driven by folks like you.
Okay.
So I don't have the text of it in front of me to know whether it would apply to your specific circumstance, but I think this is something that if it doesn't, you and other business people like you ought to, you know, raise that issue with the legislature. I mean, because they have made progress on that issue.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. 239-1310. 239-1310. It's After News with Amos. We're with the United States Attorney talking about violence. When we come back, United States Attorney shared some information which came from IMPD in terms of some of the increases that have occurred just from 2011 to 2012 in terms of aggravated assaults in certain neighborhoods of the city. We'll talk about that and more. It's After News with Amos with the U.S. Attorney. In our first hour and our second hour, Tamika Catchings, plus how well African-Americans and Indians, how well y'all voted last year. We'll tell you that. Plus, the city has settled a civil suit with the family of Brandon Johnson. In our 2 o'clock hour, we'll tell you how much the settlement was for. It was six figures, by the way. It's After News with Amos, After These. We're back with the United States Attorney Joe Hoggs at your opportunity to talk with him. The neighborhoods where there's heavy violence, and just looking at the number of aggravated assaults with guns, with weapons, since 2007, the top two area, or the top four or five, it was really two areas that are like way out there, and that's the Near East Side of the city and the Far East Side of the city. Then third, this kind of like drops off a little bit, the Riverside neighborhood, then it drops off some more, and then Martindale Brightwood, then it drops off a little bit more, and it's the Near West Side, then Eagledale, then the Near Southeast Side. In looking just at this spurt of homicides that's all across the board, it's not, you can't say it's all drug related. You can't say it's all domestic. I mean, it's just a mixture. The two top areas of the city are the Far East Side and I would say the basic East Side of the city. How important is it now, both from the city's point of view and from the federal point of view, that more data is shared with the community? So the community is looking at some of the same information that law enforcement is looking at to really understand what is going on out here.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think in the past, Amos, of course, I've served as United States Attorney for just a little over 2 years, so I wasn't personally involved earlier than 2 years ago. But I don't think it's unfair to say that maybe in the past, information regarding rates of crime wasn't easily obtainable, but that has changed. This administration, particularly under Chief Height and Public Safety Director Troy Riggs. I know, for example, that Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry has changed the culture of providing data to people who are outside the law enforcement community so that they can be aware and be empowered by that information as they go about the business of trying to help protect their communities.
Yeah, and you're going to be assigning one of your deputy United States attorneys to be working with the Marion County prosecutor?
Yes, in fact, Marion County Prosecutor Curry several years ago designated one of his top gun prosecutors to serve as both a Marion County deputy prosecutor and what we call a special assistant United States attorney. Mm-hmm. And that person serves a very valuable role for both the Marion County Prosecutor's Office and the United States Attorney's Office in helping us screen the kinds of gun-related crime that occurs.
Right.
And to make decisions as to whether those instances are most appropriately prosecuted in state court or whether they are appropriately prosecuted before a federal district court judge.
Let me go back to the phones in B at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
I have a question. Amos, you have a listener named Brenda that calls in quite often, and it's about, she has a son. Somehow or another, her son was kind of mistreated when he was in school. And she said something one time about, well, she's mentioned this several times, about she got a fraudulent letter from someone. And you would think that would be important. You know, it's easy to talk about guns and things like that, but let's talk about the 800-pound gorilla. What about white-collar crime? Mr. Hawkshead.
Yeah.
You want to know what he's doing about white-collar crime? What you do, other than Tim Durham, what else are you doing about white-collar crime?
Well, in fact, I'm glad the question was asked because we do do things in the United States Attorney's Office beyond trying to identify, investigate, and prosecute gun-related crime and drug-related crime. Our white-collar emphasis, Amos, over the last year has been considerable. You have already mentioned the single largest white-collar criminal prosecution in our state's history when Tim Durham and two of his associates were convicted this past summer. Mr. Durham has been sentenced to serve 50 years in jail. He's over the age of 50, so if his appeal is denied, Mr. Durham essentially faces the rest of his life in prison. But it's not just limited to the Durham case. There have been many cases prosecuted by the office over the course of the last year or two involving fraudulent activity on the part of Ponzi schemers and other charlatans who have bilked hundreds of thousands of dollars out of the hard-earned money of perhaps naive investors. And that has been a priority.
There's also been some governmental officials that have been
also in our priority in the white-collar criminal area has been our emphasis on public corruption prosecution and public integrity prosecutions. Lincoln Plowman, a former city county counselor, is now in federal prison for being convicted of soliciting a bribe and extortion. Former city county counselor Paul Bateman recently entered a guilty plea on charges of fraud and theft. So it really has been a comprehensive approach to white-collar criminal activity, both in the private sector from unscrupulous investors and in the public sector. Just a few weeks ago, we indicted a township trustee down in Sullivan County who was essentially using the public's money to pay himself and to pay his spouse more than the law allowed them. He channeled contracts to his family members, or is alleged to have channeled the contracts to his family members, and he will now be, he will now face federal prosecution.
All right, appreciate it, B. Let me go to David at 239-1310. Hi there.
Yes, Attorney Hofstetter, in the government's fight with drugs in our community and across urban America, has the federal government ever tried to hit the hierarchy of the drug lord in this country or other countries who are allowed to ship illegal drugs into this country?
Great question. What's being done to get Mr. Big or Mr. Mrs. Big?
Yeah, in fact, I think that's a good way to describe the difference between the obligations that IMPD has, for example, to keep drugs out of our neighborhoods as they do every day, and then what federal law enforcement is particularly and uniquely able to do. The difference is that at the federal level, we have a certain luxury of time and distance, and we are more interested in dismantling drug trafficking organizations. We are more interested in prosecuting those high-level, very well-funded, very sophisticated, essentially, Amos, business organizations. That's what they've become, these drug trafficking organizations, and follow the path wherever the path takes us. More often than not, a drug transaction that occurs on the west side of Indianapolis will find a source, perhaps up in Chicago, and that source will lead us to Denver, and then that source will lead us oftentimes to San Diego or Los Angeles, or in many cases across the border down in Mexico. So whereas IMPD's focus is on keeping the streets drug-free here in the city of Indianapolis, the United States Attorney and our federal law enforcement partners are attempting to take those drug buys that occur here on the streets of Indianapolis and find out where the chain leads us, and to hold everyone in that chain accountable.
At one point when now Congresswoman Susan Brooks was sitting in the seat that you sit as United States Attorney, Project Safe Neighborhoods, and this is going back at into the early part of the last Bush administration, was very visible and very active in terms of resources, not just to augment local law enforcement, but also to have visibility in neighborhoods. Is that coming back?
Well, Congresswoman Brooks was very successful during her tenure as the United States Attorney. I believe she assisted in obtaining a $5 million grant for the city of Indianapolis, which is, at least in my world, that's a chunk of change. And as a result of that grant, the comprehensive anti-gang initiative came to bear fruition. What that was, Amos, in short, was a holistic approach that wasn't just focused on prosecution, wasn't just focused on enforcement, but rather also had elements of how do we prevent the crime from occurring, and then at the other end of the spectrum, how do we prevent people who have made mistakes from making those same mistakes once they have done their time. So there was an element of reentry and avoiding of recidivism as part of that comprehensive strategy. Now, to directly answer your question, I would welcome the opportunity to have that kind of initiative continue in the city of Indianapolis. But the plain fact is that with the federal budget debate being what it is, I wouldn't be holding my breath that there are going to be large sums of grants coming in.
Is any of what you're trying to do here affected by the sequester?
Well, it is, and we're just trying to do more with less money. As you know, when the continuing resolution was passed a few months ago to fund the federal government until the end of the fiscal year, the sequestration cuts were included in that continuing resolution. So the United States Attorney's Office, as an example, is operating at essentially 5 to 8% less in terms of dollars than what we would have had in fiscal year 2012. And yet we're increasing our commitment. We're increasing our profile largely because we have dedicated employees in the office who want to do everything they can to make the streets of Indianapolis and throughout Indiana as safe as possible.
Let me go to Pierre at 239-1310. Hi there.
Oh, good afternoon, Amos, and good afternoon, Mr. Hogsett.
Hi, Pierre.
Just want to get right to it. This is this federal initiative by the United States Attorney. Amos, to me, these aren't federal issues. This is not something that I think it's just grandstanding by Mr. Hogsett. Let me tell you why. And Mr. Hogsett's got it in his office. He's got another complaint from me about a gun that was stolen out of my car.
Hold it. If you have filed a complaint, you're putting him. He can't comment. He can't comment one way or another.
But let me comment.
Oh yeah, because but it's not fair for you to comment, and he can't answer the question because of the restriction he has, because he can't comment on any pending case or any investigation he may or may not be doing.
Be broad, then. Can I be broad?
Very.
I'll be very broad.
Very broad.
Mr. Hogsett could go after several judges in this town for violating my rights under the color of law. Mr. Hogsett could go after several individuals who are federal officials. No, hold on. I just want to make my say. He could investigate because there are crimes out there committed, and they've got videotape evidence. Here's my point. There are things that Mr. Hogsett could be doing on the federal level that, if he went after these corrupt officials, could set a whole lot of people free, not just Pierre, okay, but a whole lot of people free. And he could send the message to those in federal office and those in high positions of authority that you cannot trample people's rights. This has nothing to do with any federal. This is the Joe Hogsett put my name in the paper deal. That's all this is. Murders, those aren't federal issues unless they happen on federal property. These are state issues. So let's just be real and let's get to the point. And quite frankly, Amos, we need a special prosecutor to look into some of these allegations because it's clear that Mr. Hogsett is not going to do his job. And it's not just on Joe. It goes to the United States Attorney General and the president himself. And I want to thank you for taking my call.
Are there other, Mr. Prosecutor, are there other United States attorneys that are providing the kind of assistance that you're providing in Indianapolis in their cities?
In most every district, and this is a directive from the United States Attorney General, Eric Holder, who asked all United States attorneys to work with local law enforcement partners in trying to help identify what Attorney General Holder calls the worst of the worst. And that's the focus of our efforts. Pierre is right. Homicide is not a federal crime. Mm-hmm. And frankly, to the extent that homicides occur, they are prosecuted by the Marion County prosecutor. Terry Curry's office does an outstanding job in that regard. But certainly, armed career criminals and those who traffic in gun-related weapons, gun-related crimes, I mean, those are very clearly federal violations as well as state violations. It's my obligation to help keep our streets as safe as we can.
We're with the United States Attorney, Joe Hogsett, talking about their efforts working with IMPD and the Department of Public Safety, trying to reduce the level of violence in neighborhoods. Not just our neighborhoods, but the neighborhoods where y'all know the crime is going on. 239-1310. 239-1310 in our 2 p.m. hour. We'll talk with Tamika Catchings. We'll tell you how Indiana had the 11th highest percentage of African-American voting of any state in the country in last year's election. And if that's not enough, the family of Brandon Johnson, the city has settled with Brandon Johnson and his family in a civil suit dealing with the brutality that occurred over 2 years ago. We'll tell you more about that. It's After News with Amos on a Thursday.
Got an email. So somebody wants to know the 50 homicides. Can you tell us how many are drug related, domestic, black on black, burglary, robbery, et cetera? And that, I think that comes back to getting all of the law enforcement community providing this kind of data much easier for the community to provide. Also, there's no clear cut anymore in terms of homicides. The emailer counts 50. I think that's the raw number, and then IMPD uses criminal homicides. So there's even confusion as to what's a homicide anymore.
Yeah, there's always definitional differences. Let me just say this. I don't know the statistics as to the homicides for 2013. I mean, in terms of you know, who the victim was, you know, and the manner and means of the murder. I will say, though, and you know this very well, Amos, because I have heard you on this program talk about it to the point of imploring the community to acknowledge and realize that over the last couple of years, whatever the number of homicides that the city of Indianapolis has experienced, there is a disproportionately high number of African Americans who are the victims. We're not talking about going after the criminals in this regard, but the victims of homicides. I think I remember over the last couple of years, maybe as many as 60 to 65% of the
and
of
that
victims.
These and that these violent crimes are not being driven by people under 18. I think there's that perception that it's youth, that it's kids, and that's not necessarily the case. Let me go back to the phones. And Anonymous, hi there.
Yes, thank you, Amos, for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You indicated that the east side, the north, I believe, are the south and so forth, mm-hmm. and the west side, which are predominantly black and brown, that's where most of the crimes is indicated. However, I'm finding it quite interesting that recently they found a lot of houses were used for meth labs, and they weren't in those areas. And who are the people that are using these meth labs and creating them? I don't believe they're black or brown. So could he address that for me, please?
That's a great question. And I think
thank you so much.
The meth labs, we hear a lot about them. That's not in the hood. That's in the rural areas as well as suburban areas.
Yeah, in fact, it's a good question because methamphetamine is one of those it's the only illegal narcotic where you can essentially purchase all of the ingredients needed to make the methamphetamine perfectly legally. You and I can walk into stores throughout Indianapolis and get everything we need to set up our own meth lab. The other aspect of that is that it was traditionally largely a rural and suburban challenge where these labs, which, as you know, are highly volatile and explode with some frequency. Now with this one-pot methodology where a meth dealer can basically shake and bake in his own van or maybe in a room in his home here in the city, it has become a more pervasive problem than ever before. The questioner's point, though, is well taken, and that is both local law enforcement and the DEA have prioritized methamphetamine, and the prosecution of those who are engaged in it is substantial. I will tell you from the federal perspective that the local meth dealers really can't make enough methamphetamine to create the systemic problem that we're experiencing. What local meth dealers do is create demand. In other words, they make just enough to get people hooked. And then what happens, Amos, is that's when these big cartels move in, who can truck, you know, tons of methamphetamine to be into Indianapolis to be distributed on the streets.
The other thing your office provided me, and I was stunned by this, that last year there were more robberies of pharmacies in and around Indianapolis than any other metropolitan area in the country. We were the capital of robbing a drugstore?
Yeah, we don't want to be number one in that category, and yet we are.
Are they going to the drugstore and taking the methamphetamine? Is that what's driving this?
I'll tell you what's driving it, and that is the increase of prescription drug abuse. Now, let me make it more personal. If you happen to have, unfortunately, be victimized by a burglary, mm-hmm. 20, 30 years ago, Amos, burglars would come in, they'd take your money, mm-hmm. they'd take your electronics, right?
Right.
And they'd take your jewels, mm-hmm. if you had any.
Yeah.
Now, a burglary, and any police officer can tell you, will include any guns in the home, mm-hmm. and your medicine chest will be completely...
The medicine?
Oh, of course. There is such a value on the street for prescription drugs today that prescription drug abuse has become the single fastest growing form of drug abuse in our country. And to get back to your point, that is why pharmacies, in no small measure, are being targeted for armed robberies. They want the prescription drugs.
So somebody from the FBI is going to be helping IMPD on the pharmacy robberies, because unlike a bank, when you rob a bank, that's a federal crime.
Right.
You rob a drugstore, that's a local crime. Is this a crime growing such that at some point Congress may have to look at this?
Well, it is both a violation of state and federal law, because any commercial establishment, they're called Hobbs Act robberies, any commercial establishment that is engaged in interstate commerce, if they're subject to an armed robbery, has violated, in most instances, federal law.
Oh.
And as a result, if a CVS or a Walgreens or some other drugstore is subject to an armed robbery, not only is that very serious because you have customers and employees of that store who are made vulnerable by somebody who brings a gun in and points it at people, but also you are disseminating or distributing a result of that
controlled substance.
Prescription drugs that have a street value of astronomical proportion.
Let me go to Sissy at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hello. I would just like to make a quick point.
Yes.
Being that there are ways, especially considering the state of today's political climate, financial ways that the crime problem could be offset. But unfortunately, as politicians want, the communities are really not feeding into it as they should. And our communities could use more support, especially financially. When you have people like Minister Shelley Covington, who walks across the city of Indianapolis to raise money for programs that will hopefully keep people from falling into the criminal elements, because it engages individuals and brings money into the community when our political machines cut it off, and then she can't even get help from our local pastors and other local organizations, then it really becomes to be sad. So people really need to put their money where their mouth is before they start blaming other individuals, because it does take a village, and we all do need to get on board.
Now, Sissy, you brought up a program that maybe most of my listeners are not familiar with. In 30 seconds, you were mentioning an organization. What are they and what do they do?
Minister Shelley Covington was featured on Fox 59. She walked 27 miles from 42nd and Post Road to Canby, Indiana, to raise money for UNWA, the United Northwest Association, which is number 20 in that list of targeted neighborhoods for the most crime-ridden neighborhoods in the United States. But we need to help our people by providing provisions for them because of the dwindling resources that are out there. So we need the help of our pastors and our churches and our community leaders and our neighborhood associations for the money that is not there. We need them to donate Minister Covington's organization and UNRWA so we can rebuild these coffers so we can be more beneficial to our neighborhoods to help offset the crime problems, because then we'll be able to provide what our residents need to keep them from robbing and killing people out in the street.
All right, good points. Let me go quickly to Lewis at 239-1310. Lewis, real quick.
I knew I was going to go real quick. I'll try to make it quick. I watched the movie the other night. And it said it was a true movie out of Texas about an attorney, district attorney Beckett, at one point in time, where is it true that 95% of the cases that the federal that the police do, they end up pleading down because it equals to a conviction, which they get money from the federal government for each conviction they get. If that is true, what's going on? I mean, why is it that you get, it's nothing but a money racket? That's what our political system and turn our criminal system into. And if, you know, being that I'm an IPS and, you know, one of these government school graduates, I'm not too hip on these here big words like rural. Do you mean white communities that the local media don't cover because that's where they money make their money?
I have never heard, that might have been fiction in a movie, but I've never heard the federal government giving a local prosecutor money because they get
conviction. I didn't say a local prosecutor. I'm saying, is it true that 95% of all cases end up in a plea agreement?
In your office, most of the cases plea out?
We do have a lot of guilty pleas that are entered, and it's because, pure and simple, the evidence ultimately is so overwhelming that defendants see it in their best interest to avoid the cost and expense of trial, because ultimately a conviction, in their own opinion, is inevitable. So we enter quite frequently into guilty pleas that ultimately are sentenced by the judge. In the alternative, if everyone in this country is presumed innocent until proven guilty, if they want their day in court, they have it. And we try the case, and win or lose, we try to do justice wherever we
can.
One
last thing. Okay. I just want to ask one last thing. With so many corrupt and crooked prosecutors out here, Shouldn't they have to be sworn in as well? Because I'm tired of seeing so many prosecutors getting over knowing they're not telling the truth, and then they end up with their own talk shows.
What do you mean by sworn in? When they get the
because
job, they're
they
taking off.
They manipulate the truth when they inside the court. Only one have to swear on the Bible is the defendant. But we've seen too many times where prosecutors have lied and didn't insert all the evidence that could have let somebody go. There was the New York Five boys up there in New York early in the 80s. It's all over. We have, see, the good old boy system is what's corrupting it. They don't want to hurt each other's feelings because they, at the end of the day, the prosecutors and the defense lawyers, they all in the same old racket. They go out and have dinner and drinks later in the day. I've seen it happen downtown.
All right, let me ask the U.S. attorney, isn't there a case, and you may, I mean, this may be a question you can't comment on, but I believe there was a prosecution of the former senator from Alaska. The government, there was some strong things that there was alleged misconduct on the part of those prosecutors. Were those prosecutors sanctioned?
Yes, they were. The case you're talking about is former Senator Ted Stevens.
Ted Stevens.
And the controversy in that case, Amos, wasn't necessarily what was said in court or how evidence was presented or not. Rather, if I remember correctly, most of the allegations against the government and the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Assistant United States Attorneys involved were subject to sanction, involved their failure to disclose as part of the discovery process certain evidence that could have been used by Senator Stevens' lawyers
to prove
to help,
his case, defend his defense.
Defend his case.
David's got the last call with the U.S. Attorney, Joe Hogsett. David?
Yes. This is David Smith, the president of Washington Township Board.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to congratulate the prosecutor that I know he's doing a good job, and he's very sincere about crime and very sincere about justice. and doing the right thing. I've been knowing him a long time, and so I know I have full confidence in him that he's doing as fair, peaceful as he possibly can.
I
just want to congratulate you.
Appreciate that. If you want to know what the U.S. attorney is doing, A, he's got a, if you know some public corruption, you know a politician or a public official that is corrupt, they got a phone number. And they got a red phone that you'll answer. No joke. 229-2443. 229-2443. 229-2443 on public corruption. You see something? Say something at 229-2443. And the website for the U.S. attorney is www.justice.gov/USAO/INS. One final thing. Do y'all cover West Lafayette? Is that in your jurisdiction?
Actually, Tippecanoe County is in the Northern District.
It's in the Northern, because I was going to ask you about hate crimes in Purdue, but let's save that for your counterpart.
Yep.
Up in the Northern District, Joe Hogshead is the United States Attorney for the Southern District of Indiana. Thanks very much for being with us.
It has been my pleasure, Amos, and I thank all your callers.